How many people here have ever Ubered? Okay, a few people have Ubered. So let me just explain to you, if you're not familiar with what Uber is. Uber is a company that is like a rideshare platform that they use an app. So it's a substitute or an alternative method of transportation from, say, like a taxi cab or public transportation systems. And you just download the app, you put your payment information in there, and then what they do is they basically contract drivers. And by contract, I mean they give you about 5 questions to make sure your car doesn't suck as bad as mine does. I don't think they'd let me Uber with the red car. But anyway, that's beyond the point. And they just say, okay, we're going to give you some equipment. We're going to give you an app. And then you can go and basically turn on your meter. And then if someone needs a ride, they get the Uber app. And they ask for a ride. And if you want to take that ride, you do it. So it's basically this really big rideshare company. And so when Thea and I were down in Miami a couple weeks ago, we were going to get around, and we did not want to rent a car. If you're familiar with Miami at all, you know the driving in on there is terrible. The drivers are the worst. I mean, I literally mean that, right? Everybody says, oh, the driving's the worst there. No, Miami, Florida, the worst drivers in the United States of America. I promise you, okay? In fact, just to make sure that you believe me, I was getting ready to cross a crosswalk, and I was waiting my turn, but going this direction, it was actually walk. And so this nice little old lady is walking across, and the car that's sitting right here is getting ready to turn, but it can't turn, right, because she's walking through the crosswalk. And the cab driver behind him is honking his horn. And I wanted to be like, what do you want him to do, run her over? And I'm pretty sure he would have answered yes, because he was not interested in waiting for this lady. And so that was our experience. We did not want to get a car. And so we were just deciding, okay, we're going to take public transportations or cabs or Uber. So this is our first experience with Uber. I had never Ubered before this. And it was the last day we had to get to the airport, which is about a 20-minute ride from where we were staying. And so we decided to get up early and get an Uber. And we had taken 4 different Uber rides to this point. They were all great experiences. But I tell you what, it was about to change. It was about to change, right? We just wanted to get home. And to get to the airport, we had to take a car. And so I get on my app, and I select my destination, which was the Fort Lauderdale Airport. And I request a ride, right? And then if you open the app and you see it, it gives you a little bit of an idea about how long it might take for the person to pick you up, the time frame for arrival, as well as what they're driving and what their name is. So I had Sebastian driving a Kia Forte coming to pick me up in approximately 4 minutes, okay? So that's just the setting, right? I'm just like sitting there with Theo. We're like, okay, so we're visiting. And I realize, like, this is taking a really long time. So I open the app back up about 3 minutes later, and now he's 7 minutes away. We're moving backwards now, right? And so I thought to myself, okay, it should have been a cue as to what might actually transpire in the next hour of my life. But I really didn't think anything of it. Maybe he's going to go somewhere else. And so we signed up for what would be a pool. They call it an Uber pool. And so you can actually take a discounted rate if you're willing to open up the car to other people and take alternate routes. Maybe they have to drop someone off between there and your destination. So we did that. So I thought maybe he's just picking the other person up. Nope, still hasn't picked him up. And so you can actually call your driver. And I call him. I said, hey, how's it going? We're your passengers. We're just wondering where you were. His response to me was, sorry, I don't speak much English. And I was like, okay, all right, Sebastian, no problem. And so I just said, well, how long do you think it'll be until you'll be here? And he was like, 3 minutes. I was like, okay, 3 minutes. And so we're standing on the side of the road on Collins Avenue, which is the busy streets, like the division of Miami, right? And I was like, I could see him driving down the road. Like, he's at the stoplight, the next block is us, and he pulls up to the wrong side of the road, and he just stops in the middle of the lane. Like, traffic is going bonkers, honking at him like crazy, right? And so I'm over there, like, waving. I'm, like, trying to get his attention, like, we're over here, right? And so I call him again. I'm like, Sebastian, we're across the street. Do you see me waving? He's like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, great. So he drives, pulls around, and we get in the car. Well, then, if you if you look, they have basically a GPS unit that's telling them where to go. So they don't necessarily have to know where they're going. They just follow the GPS. So on the GPS, it's telling him to go one direction to pick up the other guy, and he starts driving the other direction. So now we're going the wrong direction to pick up the other guy, and we need to get to the airport. We were smart. We gave ourselves enough time, but not enough time to drive the wrong way for half of it, okay? So he's driving the wrong direction, and I notice it, and he has no idea, right? Sebastian is approximately 65 years old, retired, not the most technologically savvy person, let's just say that, right? So he's driving the wrong direction, and I'm like looking at him, and I'm like, I don't know what to do about this, right? And so finally, there's a phone call that comes in from the other rider, and he answers the phone call, and the guy's like, hey, this is your other Uber, blah, 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 just wondering where you were. And Sebastian, speaking very little English, goes like this. He looks at me, and he goes, I was like, what does that mean? Right? Because I'm thinking to myself, what does he want me to do? So he then proceeds to ask me to help communicate with the guy that's on the phone. So now I'm talking to the other Uber potential passenger, telling him that, yes, we're driving the wrong direction. I don't think this is going to work out. We're going to cancel your ride, and you should just call another Uber, right? And so Sebastian kind of nods his head at me, agrees that that's probably the best decision. And so then he just cancels him, and so we're on our way to the airport. But Sebastian's driving, and I was like, do you want me to help put the destination in the GPS for you? And he's like, yeah, that'd be great. Not very clear, obviously. So I grab the phone, and I start to, and it's in Spanish. I'm like, I do not speak or read Spanish, okay? I took German in high school, so... So now I'm like, okay, what do I do? And I start to type in airport, and it was like El Aeropuerto de Fort Lauderdale. Did I get that right, Dan? Okay, all right. So I think, and I ask him, like, is this right? Like, we got to go to Fort Lauderdale. And he's like, yeah, that's it. He communicates to me that that's it. So we get going, and I'm like, certainly this is finally solved, and we're on our way. We got the GPS. We're in the car. We're going. Well, about 20 minutes later, it tells us to take an exit. And he drives right past the exit. And then this is what he tells me. I know better way. And I thought to myself, all right, Sebastian, you've lived here a long time. I'm going to trust you. So we get off at the next one, right, which was supposed to be the one that he knows the better way. And it is under construction. And so we can't turn the direction we're supposed to go. So now we are officially lost, right? And so we have to make a U-turn, but there's, of course, no easy way to make a U-turn on a freeway. And so we're now approximately 45 minutes into a 20-minute ride. And at this point, I think to myself, this is awful. What am I doing, right? Like the blind leading the blind here. I'm doing a better job getting myself there than he is. And so we finally make it to the airport. And the best part of the whole thing was this. His parting remarks to me, he was very kind, very gracious. His parting remarks to me were, next time you come to Miami, you should learn Spanish. I was like, all right, Sebastian, thanks for that. So the point being is that all I wanted to do was to get home. And I tell you what, no matter how difficult or how excited I was to get home, there was bumpy roads in the way. There was all kinds of headaches, and Sebastian was one of them. I love Sebastian deep down inside, but it was a bumpy road. Well, today what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about the nation of Judah and their return home. That's what chapter 19 in the story is about. If you've been following along in the story, basically you know that it's the Bible condensed down into the major narratives and what's happening in those narratives. And the point of history that we're in right now basically is this back and forth between Israel and God, where they are calling upon God in a difficult situation, he provides, he redeems them. They go about their life in a normal way for so long, and then they forget what God's done for them, and they return to their sinful ways, much like we all do, and they end up back into a difficult situation. And so 2 weeks ago, we talked about Daniel, and Daniel's part of the situation where he's leading people, he's leading God's people in a situation where they're in exile, and they're still in exile up until this point. And God's finally going to relieve them. And he's going to allow them to return home and build the temple again, right? Because they have been far enough removed now from the previous generation and the generation that once knew what it was like to have their own land, to have their own space, and more importantly, to have the temple where they could practice their worship practices. Now, I wanted to just take a couple minutes and talk about why is the temple so important? Because this is going to kind of play a role into why this is a big deal. And the temple to us is a very, well, certainly to us here in this building, the idea of like a grand ornate space to go in and do church is not something that we're familiar with. Okay, I'm just going to say that in a nice way, right? Like this is not the temple that you would imagine it is back in their day, right? So the temple to them is very important because it is the central place where they practice worship. And what's so important about that is they were able to live in kind of a rhythmic way of worship. Now, if any of you have any kind of rhythmic characteristic to your soul, you know rhythm is amazing, right? I'm not talking about routine, I'm talking about rhythm, right? Like, have you ever seen a person who's dancing that has no rhythm? Like a Gumby doll getting electrocuted, right? Like, they're just kind of spazzing out, no rhythm. But when someone has rhythm or they have the ability to follow rhythm, it's like, yeah. And then even if you don't really have rhythm, but you can sense rhythm, like if you're not musically inclined, but you enjoy music and you know, it's like, oh, like this rhythm, you start to hear it and you just kind of groove, right? Like that's important to all of life, especially in worship. And that's what's happened is it's interrupted their rhythm. The ability to not have their own space, to not have the temple, is so important because it's rhythmic for them. And now they're out of their rhythm and everything's wacky and they don't know what to do about it. And so God's finally going to allow them to return home. If you don't believe me that rhythm is important, think about summer break for parents. Your rhythm is about to change dramatically, right? Or if you exercise at all, you know that once you're in the rhythm, it's just a lot easier to get up and go. It's a lot easier to do the thing that you're supposed to do if you're in a rhythm. The same is true for our spiritual lives. If you read the Bible, it's easy to fall off for a few days or a week, and then all of a sudden you're like, I don't even know when the next time I'm going to read is, right? Or to pray, or even to go to church. Church is very rhythmic. It's very important to be a rhythm in your life, right? It's very important. And so that was true for these people as well. It was important for them to have a rhythm. And so God recognized that. And so he is actually going to provide a way for them to go home. And that's where we pick up the story today. And so we're actually going to be reading out of passages out of a few books in the Bible. There's going to be Ezra and Haggai and Zechariah. And so there's actually quite a bit of, not time, but there's quite a bit of writing in the Bible that's spaced out in different places that's going to be covered today. But that's why the story is so cool, because it puts it in context, right? It puts it in chronological context for us. And so today we're going to start with Ezra chapter 1. And so if you want to turn there, you can follow along, or it's on page 263, chapter 19 is the beginning. And Ezra is the first of these voices that God's using to inform the nation of Judah what's happening, what's on their radar, what they should be looking in for. And so we're just going to read Ezra 1, verses 1 through 6 together. It says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. I'm going to pause there for just a second. It notes that there was a word spoken to his people, from God to his people through Jeremiah. And I just want to remind you what that is, because in order to fulfill the word, you need to know what the word is, right? The nation of Judah, we've been really familiar with this, right? They knew these words, these promises spoken. So I just want to remind you what it is. And this is from Jeremiah 29, 10 through 15. You'll probably recognize part of it at least. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and I will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. You may say, the Lord has raised up prophets for us in Babylon. And so when Ezra is talking about, when he writes this and he says, this is the fulfillment or the promise that God proclaimed in Jeremiah, that's what he's talking about, to bring you back from exile, right? But note something. 70 years it took for this to happen. And I think to myself, am I prepared to be in exile? Whatever that looks like for me or for you, am I prepared to be in exile for 70 years and remain faithful to God? That's a difficult task to imagine. That's an entire generation. That could literally be longer than my lifespan. My whole life could just be me living in exile and I would never know it, right? That's crazy to think about. And so by God bringing them out of that, they have to be just crazy excited, right? And so let's continue with Ezra. And says, this is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God of who is in Jerusalem, and may their God be with them. And in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and all their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts in addition to all the free will offerings. And so we see two amazing things happen here. If you remember weeks ago, we talked about Solomon. And his legacy was to build basically the first great temple. Up until that point, they had basically been traveling as a nation, and so they would have basically a portable space to worship the Holy of Holies. And so God said, you know what, let's establish and let's have a temple. And of course, when they got ran over and they were taken over, by people, and they were basically given into captivity because of their own sins, the temple was torn down and taken apart. Pieces were stored away. And so now we see that God is not only going to rally the troops, per se, around this idea of, again, building a temple, but he does so with total provision. He provides everything they need. In fact, you're going to see how much he provides. But he starts with having people from their neighbors, you know, assisting them, giving them silver and gold and all of the freewill offerings. I mean, it's crazy to see how God is able to move the hearts of the people. The other thing that happens is he does it through a foreign king. Like, the idea of us getting excited about something that's happening here at Center Church is one thing, but to have a completely different authority who doesn't buy into anything that we believe or want to be like, this is going to happen, and I'm going to make sure it happens for you. I'm king. I can say what I want, and it will happen. For him to be moved by God in a way that allows it to happen is incredible. It's incredible. And I think I know God uses difficult situations in life to rally people around a cause. He uses really tough situations in life to rally people to accomplish much greater things. And so there's this weird tension in life where we want things to be comfortable and good, and we want people to be happy. But then at the same time, when we look at this story and all of the things that we've learned so far through the first 18, 19 chapters where we are, it's when the difficult happens that really good things happen. It's when the difficult things that are going on in life are happening that God's able to really pull something spectacular out of the muck. And so in your life, maybe you're thinking to yourself, I just want it to be easier. But do you really want it to just be easy? Or do you want God to do something spectacular? Because I don't know about you, when things are just kind of boring and routine, see, routine and rhythm are different. Rhythm can change for you musicians or singers or anybody who understand that. Rhythm can change and still be in rhythm, but routine is kind of blah. Pastor Kelly is like the worst. Literally, he is like, oh, he's probably already over this service. He's probably over that sentence I just said. That's how quick he wants his routine to change. But the rhythms of life, the rhythms of worship, he's all about that, just like I am and just like you should be, because God will use the difficult things in your life to create something spectacular. And that's what's happening here. And he provides the way to do it. That's the difference between us and or our God and any other God. He doesn't just leave us to figure it out for ourselves. He says, I'm going to give you everything you need. So we see that happening. And so they are able to go and they're able to establish themselves in Jerusalem and begin to rebuild. If you remember Pastor Chris from last week, he talked about that same Jeremiah passage. And a couple verses before that, it talks about how they were supposed to, while they were in Babylon, they were supposed to build and establish and be part of the community. And now God's bringing them out of that, out of exile. And now they can build and establish their own community in their home. And so they're excited. And they get really amped up and they work hard and they are able to establish the foundation of the temple, right? The most basic but critical part of a building. And then something funny happens. I guess it's funny to me now, but it wasn't funny to them. They build this temple and so the foundation for the temple, and they're so excited about it, they decide to have this giant party, right? They know how to celebrate. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you think that our God is a God who wants life to be boring, you're wrong, because these people threw the biggest parties. They were week-long celebrations full of food and wine and all of the things that we were like, oh, that would be nice, right? Week-long celebrations all of the time to celebrate what God is doing in their lives, right? So they have one of these celebrations, and it says it so loud that their enemies around them take notice. They take notice, and they're like, I want that. I want to be part of that. And so they go over there and they offer to help build the temple. They offer to say, you know what? I want in on this. So let me help you so that I can be part of who you are. And the Israelites, the nation of Judah, they say, nah, right? Because you're our enemies. And just because we got the right thing going on now, you want to be part of it now? Nah, sorry. Bounce. Kick rocks, right? And so what happens is these people, they get seriously angry about that. They get really just angry, right? And they think to themselves, you know what? Fine. If you guys don't want to let us in on the party, we're going to make life difficult. And it talks about how they would do things like heckle them while they were trying to work. They would even influence people like merchants where they would get supplies, or just people who were in charge that were outside of the nation. They would influence them, or they would pay them to basically make their lives more difficult, to the point where after a few years, construction on the temple stops completely. It stops completely because they are so angry. They just took their ball and went home. They're like, you know what? No, you're not going to build this. And the funny thing to me, or I guess, like I said, funny to me now, is they actually let it affect them. They had just seen God deliver them from exile and provide a crazy way for them to build this temple and to have community again. And yet they think to themselves, maybe this isn't really the time for us to build this. And they start to reason with themselves. They start to make up excuses as to why, because they don't want to offend anybody. It's kind of invasive. So, you know what, let's just stop building that and we'll just focus on building our own stuff and our houses and we'll just go over here and we'll, maybe they'll go away. But that's not going to happen, right? And when God commands us to do something and we don't do it, how happy is he? He's not happy. And so God uses Haggai as a voice of reason. He uses Haggai to deliver a message to them that will hopefully shake the dust off of what's happening. It actually takes them 16 years to return to building the temple, right? So this isn't just like they took a week off. They took 16 years off to kind of just turn inward and focus on themselves. And God is not happy with that. And so he delivers this message through Haggai chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. I'm going to read this to you. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah. Yeah, those are names. And to Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest. This is what the Lord Almighty says. These people say, the time has not yet come to rebuild the Lord's house, right? Like he's saying, this is what they're saying. Then the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? Now this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You have planted much, but harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. You put on clothes, but are not warm. You earn wages, only to put them in a purse with holes in it. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build my house, so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why, declares the Lord Almighty? Because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with your own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew and the earth its crops. I called for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain, the new wine, the olive oil, and everything else the ground produces, on people and livestock, and on all the labor of your hands. So God interrupts their rhythm. He says, you know what? I just provided for you an opportunity to rebuild this temple, which is very important. It's the center of their worship. But instead, they're just like, you know, let's just, maybe that'll work out later, but let's just focus on building our own houses right now. Let's just take our time. Let's make sure that we're taken care of, and we'll worry about that later. And that angers God, and he says, give careful thought to your ways. Give careful thought to your ways. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever I give careful thought to my ways, it's usually a dangerous thing. Because I often find, I have discrepancies in my ways. But it's also the opportunity for God to really correct and set me on a new course for the right things in my life. And so that warning that God gives is kind of like this subtle, like when a teacher kind of looks over their glasses at you, right? And they just kind of give you that look. Like, that's what I imagine God is doing right now. Because we've seen his capability, like, That warning is kind of like I'm going to give you a little, you get one, like, right? Like, that's kind of like what he's saying. But on two is going to be a bigger deal. And so he's kind of just looking over. This is just a bad image for me, but just like his old man glasses and just kind of staring at them saying, give careful thought to your ways. What are you doing? How many times have we heard that throughout the story? Remember Elijah? He's like hiding in the caves, and God says, what are you doing here? Once again, he's saying, what are you doing? Why are you focused on building your house while my house, the God that has given you all capability, that has given you all provision, my house is in ruin? Why are you focused on building your own house? I get where they're at. I get the problem, the thing that's causing them to get there. Like they have been in exile for years, decades. And they finally have their own space again. And they're just like, yes, freedom. And then it gets just slightly difficult. Because remember, they were amped. They got the foundation done. They were amped about it. And it took the smallest amount of heckling, right? In order to just make them think, yeah, we'll get there eventually. But let's make sure that we put this new, you know, we got a chance to rebuild. Let's put a view window in. Like, let's put a deck on this time, right? We need a place for the barbecue, the gas hookups, right? And they're just focused on doing their own thing. I understand that. Except for when God calls you to do something and you don't do it, it's not a good situation. And they should know that by now. And guess what? We should know that by now. And so this challenge that we have to look at, and this is kind of where we're going to wrap up this idea, is that we need to put first things first. And what I mean by that is, what really matters most in their situation? God established it, and he's reminding them now, again, through Haggai's words. Why are you focused on building your own thing? Well, my thing lays in ruin. And so we need to put first things first. Jesus teaches in Matthew 6:33, he says, seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, right? And all of these things will be given to you as well. C.S. Lewis says it this way, talking about that very teaching. He says, put first things first, and we get the second things thrown in. Put second things first, and we lose both first and second things. That's true, is it not? I mean, that's been what God is trying to establish this whole time in this story. He's saying, I'm the first. My thing is the first, and I will give you all of the second things. But time and time again, they start to focus on the second things first, and then they end up losing everything. They end up losing everything. And so our big idea is this, and it's simple, but I tell you, it's simple by word, and it's very difficult to live out. When we put God's first as our first, he will take care of the rest. Simple. But how hard is that? How hard is that? That takes an incredible amount of faith. It takes an incredible amount of trust that if your entire life, if 70 years of your life was meant to be lived in exile, whatever exile looks for you, would you still have faith enough to remain? Because see the narrative is much bigger than one generation. Certain generations live in the prosperity of God's provision. Other generations live in the consequence of exile because of what other generations did and what they forgot to do. And I think to myself, we're just part of one of those generations. I like to think we're living in a very good time. I feel very fortunate for my life. I'm sure you guys do too. No matter how difficult it is, I feel very fortunate. But I don't want to be the generation that leaves the next generation in exile. Do you? That's, of course, rhetorical. If somebody raise their hand, we'll have a prayer meeting after. Of course you don't. You don't want that. But what are you doing about it? Are you putting first things first? That's a legitimate question. That's not an encroachment on your freedoms or anything. I'm not saying you are or you're not. I'm just asking you, are you putting first things first? I have to admit, when I was studying and preparing for this, that was a giant poke in the chest. Giant poke in the chest. And much like the rest of you, I'm doing some of those first things probably pretty well by my standards, maybe even by God's standards, but I'm probably not doing all the first things first. So this is a great question to ask yourself. And the reason is because every single person has a something that they should be part of building. God has given purpose to every single person who has called upon his name. Not a single person in this room is without purpose when it comes to building God's house. And see, where we're different from the nation of Judah, the temple is no longer a building, right? The temple is no longer a space where we have to go to practice the constitutes of the law to really worship in a way that was given to them by the law, right? They actually had to go there and practice sacrifices and all of these bring offerings in certain specific ways. And Jesus came and he changed all of that for us. He paid the bill so that those things are taken care of. And he's basically said, you know what? The temple is not a building. The temple is a people. It's each and every one of us. So now Jesus, the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit lives inside of us. And Jesus made that possible so that we don't have to be in a particular place. But I tell you, we still have particular purpose, and that's to make much of Jesus always and forever. And so God has given each and every person, including me, including you, by every person I mean all, a something that they're supposed to be a part of. And the question is, are you putting first things first? I'm going to leave with this challenge, and we're going to take communion, and we're going to sing. I'm going to leave you with this challenge. What's that first thing for you? Because like I said, it's different for each and every one of us. We know that we've all been gifted in different capacities. We've all been given different quantities of money to be generous with, or qualities of skills to be generous with, but everybody has something that they can be part of building the thing that God has called us to build, his church, right? We are collectively the temple now. And like I said earlier, I was talking about like the rhythm. It's important because we are the rhythm of his church. Each and every one of us creates this rhythm. And if we get out of rhythm, if it gets wacky, we kind of just look like Gumby getting electrocuted, right? Just kind of spazzing out on the dance floor. But God has called us into a particular rhythm, and each and every one of us plays a part of that. And it's so awesome. And I love that we get to sit here and we get to think to ourselves, I'm not getting first things first necessarily, but because of Jesus, we get a second chance and a third chance and a fourth chance. And so I want to pray for you, and then we're going to sing and we're going to take communion together. It's going to be back on the back table for you. You can do that during the last song at your own pace, on your own timing. But why don't we do this? Why don't we stand up? I'm going to pray for you that the thing that God has called you to be a part of, the thing that he's asking you to build, the thing that he's given to you specifically, the first thing, that we would just be a little bit better tomorrow at putting that thing first and let the second things fall into line. God, thanks for today, and thank you for a message like this where you're reminding us that there is truly a thing that you've called us to, and that because of those purposes, you're not going to back off. You're not going to just let us go sit in our corner and just mind our own business, but you're going to remind us and you're going to poke on us and you're going to say, put the first things first. Why are you focused on building your own house when my house needs something, when my house needs you? So God, I pray that our hearts would be turned to even more generosity for this community, that it would be turned for more generosity towards the people who come through these doors, but even the ones who don't, the ones in our workplaces and the ones at the places that we play, where we hang out and we have a good time. God, I pray that we would always be thinking about those people as the reason why you've put us here in the first place. And that we would be able to put those first things first. And let us enjoy the second things. Let us celebrate the second things in their rightful place, God. Thank you for all of the hearts of these people who have committed to you, committed to something important. We love you. We praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.